And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Did you mute everyone?
I thought I did. Yep.
Okay. I don't remember unmuting myself.
Oh, that's odd.
Okay. All right, so I think we're going to have time for questions tonight. So if you have anything burning in the back of your brain, put it in the chat window and we'll get to it later on. And we have a few different topics prepared, so I'll get right into those with a thing on YouTube technical channels. This one's called Simon Says IT, and it's basically a site which has a whole bunch of training videos. And they also have it says they have a training tutorial on certain days of the week. A lot of it seems to be Microsoft products. Here's just a smattering of some of the things they have available. You see there's Office 365, Excel, Formulae, Google Drive, and setting filters in Gmail. So it's not all Microsoft. But I thought the one that might be of interest to some people is this tutorial here, which is a tutorial on Zoom. They call it Zoom Tutorial for Beginners. And some of the things they have is how to set up the audio and video controls, and how to use chat. So I notice in the chat window, it's always the same people who are entering comments. So I don't know if that means people are just lurking and don't want to chat with us, or they don't know how. If you don't know how, then this video will actually explain how to use the chat function in Zoom. And there have been a few questions lately about how to set up different views. So again, there's a section right there on the gallery view and the speaker view, and how you can best view the various windows that are available in Zoom. So there's the link to that particular video, and the link to the main event was on the first slide. Okay, so moving along, we've got another item on YouTube Tech, and this is from Tom, who has a whole bunch of suggestions for us. So Tom's going to unmute his mic and tell us all about the following. But he has to unmute his mic. There we
Okay.
go.
Actually, can you give me a host so I can actually show people?
My God.
Just a second.
Share my screen.
Okay, you got it.
Share screen, and yes. And I guess I want this one. Share. Now you should. Okey-dokes. Let's go to this one. There are a variety of useful links, as you can see. A lot of the links on the internet, on YouTube, are kind of looking at things and how good they feel they work, and doing reviews of them and showing an unboxing because all these people got free stuff. But there are other more serious YouTube channels, and Twitch is one of the mainstays. They have a live stream, which is basically all the shows that they have. When they're going live, they show them all. But there are a whole variety of different shows that come on at different times. I think they're pretty much all once a week. But This Week in Tech, which is where Twit comes from, This Week in Tech. Security Now, which is on Tuesdays, Windows Weekly, Mac Break Weekly, This Week in Google. And you can access all of their videos here. They're all very discussional. There's usually several people doing them. And if you want to take a look, it's a good place to explore. Network Chuck. Coffee, hacking tech. This is his latest one, Linux for Hackers. But he does a whole variety of stuff on computers and the internet. Hacking commands, run your own AI, Build Your Own Proxy, Linux for Hackers, Hacker Skills, Ethical Hacking, Virtual Machines, Password Hacking, etc. And there's lots and lots and lots. It goes on and on. So that's a very good site. Braxton is also very useful. In particular, he concentrates on privacy. So is this a society you want? That's more philosophical. Hidden Secrets of Virtual Machines. Smash phone surveillance this way. Stay off this list. And it's a way of becoming as private as you can on the internet and controlling your feed so that you don't get hacked as well. Chris Titus is more technical. This is email, switching to Apple, the ultimate system, how to remove YouTube shorts, setting up the perfect Windows installation. So I recommend looking through his stuff. It's really nice. Dave's Garage is a kind of eclectic thing. He did a contest where he compared programming languages, running a it was somebody's sieve to detect all the prime numbers from 1 to 1,000. I think it's 100,000 or 1 to 1,000,000. And comparing them for their speed and so on. But he does a lot of other things. He's an ex programmer for Microsoft. He's created a bunch of projects. So he has old stuff because he's the one that created Task Manager, Pinball, Zip Folders. He's responsible for those. He was the either the manager or the programmer for those. And so there's a lot of things that are interesting, but it's none of them are really very basic, except the latest things where he's actually getting into where now he's getting into OPN Sense and home networks and being able to protect yourself there. Brett and Tech are basically lists and lists of 10 free programs, 7 useful websites, 9 free software, 55 most useful Chrome. If you like lists, this is the guy. For a change of scene, BigClive.com. This is a British guy. He has a whole bunch of dissections, basically, of different, mostly Chinese, inventions or gadgets and so on. And he takes a look at them from a safety point of view and what's in there. This is his latest, the vibratory orange juicer. That seems that he's gotten a little risque, I think. Echo egg. Well, I guess he's handling all the sexes. Free lithium. In fact, actually, the free lithium batteries you can get for something that you can get lithium batteries for cheap by buying things that have them in. In fact, if you have a fairly young PC that doesn't work, you can often take apart the batteries and get the cells out of it. And some of them may be okay, and some of them may be dead to the world, but you can use the ones that are good for flashlights and stuff. So he has a variety of things. This will kill you. He will. So it's interesting that the things he takes apart. Now for a loony link, there's Doors Open for Music at Southminster. This is on Elmer and Bank. So this is, they have a variety. They have a music concert every Wednesday at noon. So you can go live, and it's a donation. And they have a. They also stream it live. And it's also, the live streams are all up here as well. Primary colors, the Roaring Twenties. It varies. It's jazz. It's romantic. It's classical. It's chamber works. It covers the whole spectrum. And Tony and Chelsea Northrup, they run a photography channel, and they do a variety of things. It's about half about taking pictures and things about that, and then the other half is kind of technical stuff. DIY ring lights, the Canon tutorials, and so on. And I recommend them. And there's one more that I think I had. Let's see if I can. Anyway, I will stop there. So those are Brennan's links, and I find them useful, the computing stuff. I find it entertaining, the Dom stuff, if I don't get to the live concert, which I have gone to a few times, and interesting stuff. So that's it for me.
Okay, thanks, Tom. So if my brain got my... Okay, there we are. Right, so these are the ones that are in the deck, and Tom had a few extra ones in there, so we'll see what we can do. Okay, next up I have an item which I found just today. I was trying to use TeamViewer with a friend who had a computer problem. TeamViewer is a kind of a remote control software, and you have to basically kind of handshake between my machine and her machine. And this time, somehow we got the password wrong, or something happened. I tried to reconnect, and I got this message which says that my license now limits the maximum session duration. Immediate reconnects are blocked. And you notice it says, please try later or upgrade your license. Please try later or pay us some money, because I'm using the free version. And connections will be blocked until 1400. And then when you try at 1400, it's blocked till 1401, and then it's blocked till 1402. And so I think if that persists, which it looks like it will, that's it as far as I'm concerned for TeamViewer. So I may very well switch to Horrors, a Microsoft product, Quick Assist, which is built into Windows 10, basically does the same job. But you don't have to install anything because it's already part of Windows 10. And Chris gave a really good presentation at one of the regular meetings, and a member's favorite, on Quick Assist and how to use it. So if you're interested in remote control software, either as the sender or the receiver, then I recommend taking a look at this deck of Chris's and see what you think of Quick Assist. And if you're using TeamViewer already, then just be aware that that may be an issue for you too.
One thing before we leave that there are some benefits to TeamViewer beyond what Quick Assist will allow you to do. Quick Assist really is intended to be used when there's a person at both ends. One of the ways you can use TeamViewer is set up your own computer so that you can remotely access your home computer from somewhere else. And so that capability is not built into Quick Assist. So if you need that, you need either TeamViewer or something like it that has that additional capability. But I use Quick Assist all the time, and when it is used in that manner, when you're trying to just help out somebody else, it's great. And there are no time limits. Only the person who is assisting somebody else needs to have a Microsoft account. The person receiving assistance doesn't have to have a Microsoft account, and it just works really smoothly.
Okay, good to know, Chris. Thanks very much. Okay, so next up we have an item from Chris, the share.
Yeah, so this is something I just came across. I had it actually recorded on my PVR, and I just watched it last night, and it was actually a really, really interesting show. So PBS Nova, I think most people are probably familiar with them, scientific type of presentations and documentaries and things like that, and they had one titled AI Revolution, and it was a really, really good overview of some of the aspects of AI and how it's affecting us and things like that. So it is season 51, episode 51. That should be episode 5. URL is there, and I'll paste it in a second into the chat. It does appear to be geo-blocked. So when I tried to get to it just using Chrome or Edge or whatever, it just said video is unavailable. And it didn't say in your location or anything like that. I suspected it might be geo-blocking, and so I fired up Opera, turned on the VPN in there, and I was able to get to it no problem at all. So if you are interested in watching it, use Opera or some other form of VPN to get around the geo-blocking, and highly recommend it. It's a great one-hour way to waste your life.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And Chris, you have the next one coming up is a question that came in on tracking devices.
Yeah, okay, let me just paste that last one in there. Yeah, so this was an interesting one. Glenn sent this into the suggestion box email address, and so he saw a story on the news about motorists coming back to Montreal and needing to be on the lookout for tracking devices. Typically, it was, say, Apple AirTags was what it was all about. And it was focused on two possibilities about why these people were doing this, tagging cars, either car theft or smuggling of drugs, firearms, things like that. And he was wondering if there is an Android app that can actually scan for AirTags, because Apple being Apple, never really tried to do anything on the Android side of it. Certainly you can't set up AirTags using an Android device, but it turns out there are some options on the Android side for being able to scan. He wondered how close he must be in order to scan for AirTags. Does it require wireless data service? How long do you have to have the app running to detect something? And can the app use a direction finder? And can you cause an AirTag to beep to locate it? And the answer to those, most of the questions, is pretty favorable, actually. Next. So there is an app in the Google Play Store called Tracker Detect. It's a free app actually from Apple. And it does look for AirTag and, they say, compatible devices, but I'm not sure there's anything that is considered by Apple to be compatible to AirTag. It uses Bluetooth, gets a really bad score. You can see the number of one-star reviews vastly overwhelms all the other scores on it. And one comment on one of the people that used it, they said they scanned for AirTags that were attached to a couple of dogs that were within 10 feet. And it only detected one of them. So one of the problems with it is that it doesn't seem to be very reliable. And this does actually answer one of the questions about detecting AirTags, is that it does use Bluetooth. Because it's using Bluetooth, you're limited to about 30 feet from the tag, is about the farthest you can expect to be able to pick up that that tag. Next. So there's another one that I found in the review of the first one. There was a mention of it was such a lousy app that you should actually go and get this other one that is in the Play Store called AirGuard, AirTag Protection. And it periodically scans all around wherever you happen to be for tracking devices like AirTags and others. So there are some other ones additionally to, in addition to AirTags, that it can actually detect. It got better reviews, still not stellar, but it did get a better review. Next. So I stumbled across this, and it turns out that Android actually has a built-in facility called Unknown Tracker Alert, and it's actually kind of cool, and it's very descriptive, unlike the other apps and so forth that are out there, in exactly what it does and exactly how you use it. So currently it is only working with Apple AirTags. They say it that way, currently only works with, so presumably they're considering at least that they may actually have it work with other trackers. So those Apple AirTags are described as being small devices you can attach to items like keys or backpack, and then you can locate them if they get lost. So that's the non-nefarious use of it. Trackers can also be used nefariously to track other people without their knowledge or consent. So the Unknown Tracker Alert is actually sent if someone else's tracker is out of Bluetooth range from the owner and it is detected to be traveling with you. And you actually have to have it that you're physically moving with the tracker over time. They don't describe exactly the amount of time in order to receive an actual alert. Now, there is a manual method that foregoes that need, but in order for you to get the alert come to your phone, you actually have to have those two conditions. So it does alert you to the tracker, tells you how to find it, and tells you what to do next. And I'll be pasting this information into the chat as soon as I'm done here. Next. So what you do is you go to the Settings app, and you go to Safety and Emergency. Next. And then you scroll down to the bottom is Unknown Tracker Alerts. Next. And then this was interesting. I found on my phone, I never turned it on. And when I checked it, it was actually on. So I presume that that is actually a default, that it is turned on. And you can see down at the bottom, you can actually initiate a manual scan. And that's where you don't have to worry about whether this tracker is moving with you and you're both in motion. If you do a manual scan, it will just look in real time for any trackers that are around you. Next. And then once you initiate the manual scan, you'll get this progress bar going along saying that that it's trying to check for trackers. Next. And then in my case, it said no trackers were detected after about 30 seconds or so. So I presume if there was an Apple AirTag that was alive around me, it would actually come up with something. But I've never had an alert come up. And I've never, in a manual scan, I never had to actually detect anything either. Next.
I think Tom has a question.
Okay.
Not so much a question, it's just a comment. I have an AirTag attached to my bicycle and an iPad that I use once in a while. I just updated it yesterday. So if it's separated from its owner, it must be separated from its owner for more than a day at least. For it to actually work, assuming that it does work.
Is that what you, in your experience, that? Because normally Bluetooth devices, I mean, for example, if I have a, you can set up Windows so that if you're a Bluetooth device that you have, such as a mouse or something like that, is separated from the computer, after about 30 seconds, it'll lock the computer. And I was just wondering if it's that sort of thing as well, if it really needs to be separated for a day, because the Android doesn't say how long it has to be separated.
Well, all I'm saying is that I have an AirTag within 20 feet of me,
yeah.
and I just did a manual scan on my Pixel 6 to see if it was detected, it was not connected to my iPad. My iPad has been off for the last 24 hours approximately.
Okay.
So it was probably has to be separated for more than a day, I'd guess.
Huh.
Or alternatively, my AirTag may be dead, but it's another possibility.
Okay.
I'll have to check on my iPad.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, a lot of this, I'm going by guess and by golly on this because I don't really have an AirTag that I can test with or anything like that. Just saying what's there. So next slide.
Just a comment from me too, Chris. I have a Samsung phone and this app is enabled on my phone too by default.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's good to know. Okay, so if you actually do find a tracker through that facility, this is what you can actually do. You can actually tap on the notification that you get, and it'll actually open up a map. And then you can find where the tracker has been detected and moved over time, actually, because it is a matter of if you're getting the notification, it means you're moving with the tracker. You can tap on play sound, and that will actually cause the tracker to make a sound. The owner will not be notified that you made it sound off, but then you can actually follow the sound to try and find exactly where the tracker is. If you find the tracker, you can tap on next steps, and then they have some on-screen instructions, and there's lots of details at the URL, which I will paste into the chat window right now. And so basically, that's all I have that I found on it in the couple of days since this actually came in that I was able to investigate and look into a little bit on the actual Android device. So I highly encourage anybody who's looking for trackers, check out either the two apps or actually the better app that's in the Play Store or the native support within Android to actually detect trackers. And if anybody has success with it or anything to pass on to the group. By all means, we could add in information in a future Q&A.
So Harvey has a comment. He says he has an AirTag in his trunk. And when he goes into a store, i.e. away from the car, AirTag says that he left his car behind.
Meaning he's supposed to drive it into the store?
And Josh had a couple of questions. I don't know if you know the answer. He says, to track your car if it's stolen, don't you want to prevent the thief to detect it, i.e. the tracker? And he's curious as to how the signal from the tracker gets to the owner anywhere in the world.
Actually, that one is the case in point on that is that you do want it to be detected by others. The way the Apple ecosystem is set up for AirTags is that if you are separated from your AirTag, anybody else with an Apple device who happens to be just passing the tracker can actually detect the tracker and report automatically to, presumably it's an Apple server somewhere, that this AirTag has been found at the following location. And then you can actually go on the Apple service and you can say, where is my AirTag? And if there is anybody anywhere in the world who has been close to that tracker recently, it should show up on a map and tell you exactly where your tracker is. So that's why the power, I guess, of the AirTag system is that there are so many Apple users that there's a high likelihood that no matter where your AirTag ends up, that there's going to be some Apple device pretty close by over a period of time that will report to you exactly where that AirTag is located.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So it'll be interesting to see if anybody does have any experience with these things in the coming weeks. Okay, so the last prepared item we have is something on backup. Because as everybody knows, World Backup Day was on March the 31st, which was just a few days ago. So everybody, of course, rushed out and got some software and backed up their computers, didn't you? If you didn't, I have a, you know, I've been using Mac and Reflect for a long time, the free edition, and now it's no longer free. I've been looking at other options. And one of the options I found recently is a product called Foxconn. And I quite like this. It's an open source product released under the general public license. It's from a guy called Andy Hardwick and his co-developer Larry Hale, who I believe is now deceased. And it says it's for Linux only and it's only 64-bit. Now, that's a little bit misleading because it basically runs as a live distro. So if you can download the software and burn it to a USB or a CD or a DVD, you can run the program directly from the live device. And there is no installation routine, so you can't install it. You actually run it from a live USB, or I run it from a live USB. And the good thing about that is you don't actually need to develop a recovery disk, a rescue disk, because the USB is the rescue disk, as it is the actual application. The bottom line is it's a kind of a front end for a program called Partition Clone. It supports both MBR and GPT as the formatting disk partitioning systems. And file systems, it supports NTFS and FAT32 for Windows users and EXT4 for Linux users. So it basically got all the major bases covered. It comes in two different versions. There's a version based on Ubuntu 18.04, which is for machines made prior to 2019. And there's a newer version based on 20.04, Focal Fossa, which I downloaded to make my live USB. And so if you have a live USB, you boot up from the USB stick and you get this desktop. So this is a Linux desktop, but it shouldn't be terribly concerned. It looks just like Windows. It has a menu button in the bottom left-hand corner. There's a taskbar down here. There's a bunch of icons, and one of the icons is this obvious one called Foxclone. So if we double click on Foxclone, then it launches the program, and the first thing it does is it reads the, or it interrogates the computer and looks to see what kind of drives it has and what kind of partition structure is on any given drive. So this is the kind of main screen once the analysis portion has been done. And you can see basically it's split into two areas. There's an area which is the source or the drive or the partitions for which you actually want to make the backup. And you can see here, pretty obvious, they use Linux notation. So SDA is a hard drive, SDB is a different drive. But it's pretty obvious from the description what we're looking at. And there's a 250 gig SSD, so that's my main hard drive in the computer. Here's it says 32 terabyte Western Digital MyBook, which is an external USB. I don't know where it gets 32 terabytes from, because this is actually only a 4 terabyte drive, so whether it's trying to tell me it's 3.2 terabytes formatted, I don't know, but it's definitely not 32 terabytes. And then the third one here is a 64 gig, again 62 gig formatted SD card. So clearly, you know, this, I'm going to be backing up the SSD, and I'm going to be backing it up to, I'm going to use the MyBook external USB drive as my target drive. So if I select the drive I want to back up, this SDA here, the 250 gigabyte SSD, by default, it selects all of the partitions. So this is a GPT type drive. It's got multiple partitions. I think there are 10 partitions in total. Some of them are FAT32, some of them are NTFS, and down the bottom, some of them are EXT4. So there's a mixture of Windows and Linux partitions on this particular drive. And as I say, by default, I'm going to back up everything on the drive that I've selected. And then when we look at the destination drive, I have some options here. And I told you I want to use this 4 terabyte My drive here. So if I select that, then I get a dialog box which lets me drill down. So I go from my book to a folder called Z Images to a folder which I've created called Foxclone. And now I can, by default, it gives it the name of the file that it's going, or the folder that it's going to generate. It uses the date, the time date stamp, and a dot backup as the extension for that particular folder. So I can tell it to save that. And then the final thing it does before we get going, it gives me a dialog which shows me what it's going to do. And it wants me to confirm that this is correct. So it's saying the source drive is my 250 gig SSD. All the partitions are selected. The destination drive is my 4 terabyte MyBook external USB drive. I'm going to this Z Images Foxclone date.backup folder, and I can say okay. So everything's kosher. I'm happy. That's what I want to back up. I just say okay. And now it goes off and gives me these progress bars. So the top one here is telling me how it's doing with the current partition that it's making the backup of. And the bottom one is telling me how it's doing for the drive as a whole. And if you look at this one, it's done the first couple of partitions, which were recovery partitions, fairly small. And it's working on the 150 gig NTFS drive here. See, it said it started it. That's my main C drive, the Windows drive. It took it 4 minutes to do these first few recovery type partitions, and it wants another 36 minutes to finish the whole thing. So my full backup is going to take about 40 minutes. So that's time to go get a coffee and let it rip. And when I come back, I get this screen which tells me that the backup is complete, and indeed it took 42 minutes and change. And so if I go now to my external USB drive and drill down to the Z-Images folder and the Foxconn folder, you can see that I've got a bunch of files all with that date of 2024.03.03.backup. And then there's a whole bunch of kind of subsidiary files which belong to that. So in the main, each partition has a pair of files which are associated with that partition. So there's an image file, which is a gzip type file. So this is a compressed image of that partition. And then there's a log.txt file, which is a description of what that image contains, which Foxconn can read these text files and figure out how to get back things that you, when you want to restore things. So this is my image of all the different partitions made on this particular date. So if I wanted to restore something now, then I move away from this backup tab here. I move to the restore tab, and now I do the same thing, but kind of in reverse. Now I choose my source drive, which is going to be the external USB drive. That's where my backups are located. So if I choose that, then it says, okay, now you drill down to the Foxconn folder, and then pick the directory or the folder, pick the backup set that you wish to restore. So see, I've got three here. There's one done on the 15th of February, one on the 3rd of March, and one on the 13th of March. So I can pick any of those and then tell it to open. So now I've chosen one down here. I've chosen the March 3rd one. And again, by default, it's choosing to restore all of the partitions in that folder, in that backup set. And the destination is going to be my SSD drive, the 250 gig SSD. And that's by default. By default, when you restore a backup, you can only restore the backup to the drive where you made that backup. Which is fine, because that's exactly what I want to do. I'm backing up my main system. If I want to restore something, I want to restore it to my main system. So that works fine as far as I'm concerned. But if you want to move everything, or just an individual partition, you want to move it from one drive to another, then you don't use backup and restore. You use the clone tab. And the clone tab's down here, and it works similarly. The other thing you can do with Foxconn is you can look at the various settings. So in the settings tab here, you can see that by default, it's set to compress the backup files. So it uses this gzip program to create zip backups. You can split the backup files if you wish. If you noticed, each of my partitions had one image file. So if it was a 50 gig image, then it would be a 50 gig file. But if you only wanted them to be 10 gigabyte portions, then you could split it and then tell it how big you want the different partitions to be. You can change the font size of things. You can enable debugging. And an important one here is, if you remember by default, it selected all of the partitions on the drive that I selected to be backed up. If you want to be able to specify, I only want this partition, I only want two or three partitions, I don't want everything, then you must check this box that says enable partition selection. By default, that's left unchecked and it selects everything. If you want to select one partition, like let's say a dedicated data partition, and that's all you want to restore, then you need to check this and then go into restore and select the partition that you want to restore. One of the nice things I like about it's actually about this program is very similar to Rescue Zilla, which I talked about many moons ago, another kind of live distro type backup program. The nice thing about FoxClone is it has a really good user guide, and it's very well documented. You look at a sample page here. You can see there's text which tells you how to do stuff. There's an index which tells you where various things are located within the document. It has screenshots and highlights and pullouts to tell you exactly how to drive the system. It's really, really very well documented. And that's all I have for that.
Tom had a question. Is it only used data that gets backed up?
Yes, I believe it is. Yeah. So
yeah,
if there's free space in a partition, then that would not be backed up by a backup. It might be by a clone, because clone typically does it bit by bit.
Yeah. Okay. And he also mentioned So this would be a method to move partitions around on the destination disk.
Exactly,
I think it's more. Wouldn't it more to be the point of moving partitions to a different physical disk?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And then, Elizabeth has a comment, I guess, FoxClone looks intuitive and easy to use, probably better than file history. It's a different sort of purpose than file history. File history, I find that its real strength comes from twofold. It has version control, so you can keep multiple versions of a file as well as near real-time backup. So you can have it running, and as you're creating files, saving files, it will be backing them up as frequently as every 10 minutes. It'll look for new or changed files. And you do have that version control where you can keep multiple versions going back years of a particular file as it's changing that you can actually recover. So I think that's where file history really comes into play. Image backup, I think they're as important, but it's for a different sort of purpose, really. It's for disaster recovery is its primary strength, as well as being able to recover things that file history, you point to particular folders that you want backed up. It does not back up things like, you know, whatever under your program files folder. So if you happen to, you know, have a configuration file under there or something like that, you'd be able to get it out of an image backup, but you wouldn't be able to get it back from file history.
Okay. All right. So we're in the last 10. We're in the last 17, I think.
Yeah.
If anybody has any other questions, now's the time to bring them forth.
You can unmute yourself and ask it audibly, or throw it into the chat.
And I just mentioned, I'm not a fan of file versioning. I find it very complicated. Maybe I just make too many versions of different files, but I end up with a whole raft of versions of stuff. And personally, I find it easier just to make a daily incremental backup of my data my data partition, and then I've got different versions, albeit each of them is a day old, but typically for my purposes, I find that's good enough. And I use FreeFileSync to do an instant snapshot of my hard drive every time I use it, and so I have kind of day-old versions of stuff plus the very latest version of everything on my data partition.
Yeah, let me show you why I think that versioning is really, really useful. Let me get a folder here with some files. So, let me share this. And okay, so here's a copy of, or it's my repository under my Google Drive of Ottawa Public Library presentations for this year. And in this case, I'm looking at the files for my presentation called Wool Backup. Now, say I'm working on this file. Which is one here? Wool Backup PPTX. So that's my main PowerPoint file. And so I work on this and I modify it on an ongoing basis, and I'll be adding slides, removing slides and things like that. And occasionally I'll run into a case where I say, well, I used to have a slide that described something different and I took it out for some reason, but I actually want it back. Now, if I want that back, I can right click on that and I can go to properties. And then in the properties dialog box, we have previous versions. And then you look through here, and I have all these multiple versions of this file that I can go back to. I can go and I can open it directly, and then it would display that in PowerPoint. And I could see, is that the one that had the slide that I wanted? No, it's still not there. I could go back to an older version and so forth. So I personally find versioning is very, very useful. It uses a very small amount of space on the drive. Like I'm backing up, you know, through file history, I'm backing up a huge amount of stuff, and I can tell you that the total backups right now, if I can find it, file history, I've got, I think I'm currently set to 9 months worth of backups, and it's using 217 gigabytes of space. And so for all of my important files, documents, pictures, things like that, not all my pictures, of course, because I've got close to a terabyte worth of pictures, but recent stuff in my pictures and pretty much everything else on documents, you know, I've got going back 9 months. All of the versions are available to me. And so it just does it. It's really nice. The interface into it is really handy to just right-click on the file, go to the properties, go to the previous versions tab, and, you know, pull back these old versions. And they're all dated. I can go in and clean up my old backups if I decide that 217 gigs is too much space for them. I can go in and I can say, well, I'll only keep the last 3 months worth of my my backups, things like that. So personally, I find that versioning is a really, really useful thing. Your mileage may vary, but personally, I find that it actually works really nicely. Yeah, Tom.
Oh, yeah, you were apparently sharing your window.
Oh, sorry. And so
we couldn't see the list of files.
Yeah, okay. Hang on a second. Let me just do that again, then I'll share my whole screen. My apologies on that. So here's the, now I don't know if things are too small. Can everybody see what it's showing there? I'm on a 4K monitor, but if I go to the properties dialog box on that file, I then have previous versions tab, and then I could see all of the previous versions that I have available of that file. And they're all date stamped and so forth. So I can actually go back in, I can open it, or I can restore a particular version. Or if I want to keep the version that is current and recover this one, I can say restore to, and it'll restore it to another location so that I then have both versions of the file available to me.
What happens if you open it?
It'll open up in PowerPoint. So if I open up that file there, see as I'm sharing that, there's the file. And notice the title bar for it, we'll back up, and then it has the actual date and timestamp of when that was actually saved by file history. And there's the file, and it's just open like a normal PowerPoint file, and I can go through it, and I can decide, oh, okay, I could copy out a particular slide, paste it into another presentation file, or I could save this file under a new file name, whatever I want to do. I find file history is quite useful. Now, file history, I've gone into this before, because when I did presentation on Free File Sync over four Q&A sessions, Microsoft seems to be lobotomizing file history. So under Windows 11, it's problematic. They've taken away the settings app for it, and you can only configure it through Control Panel now. And Control Panel has some limitations. It does not allow you to add folders to the default list. The workaround for that is it does back up all libraries. So if you create a new library, you can then add random folders to that, and then file history can back those up. They've taken away some other things. I think that what Microsoft is doing is they want everybody to use OneDrive in the cloud, and they want to use that for a couple of purposes, one of which I think is a good idea is you have offsite backup, where file history pretty much has to be a drive that is constantly attached to your computer. It can be disconnected for a period of time and it continues to function, but it really expects it to be there all the time. So Microsoft wants you to use OneDrive, which is good for backing up offsite. But a lot of people run out of space on OneDrive and then they start getting told, oh, you're out of space, and they don't know how to deal with it. And they end up buying additional space from Microsoft. And I think that's Microsoft's true purpose, is to have another revenue stream of people who run out of their, I think it's 5 gigs free space on OneDrive, and you're sort of pushed into paying for extra storage that maybe you really don't need if you use OneDrive more judiciously, let me say. So I think for now, file history is still good and useful. I would be willing to bet that Microsoft is making it more and more difficult so that at some point they will remove it completely from Windows, and there'll be so few people still using it that nobody will complain. For that reason, I think Free File Sync is probably a worthy replacement. And in my backup presentation that I give at the library, and I talk about, you know, the problems of file history in Windows 11 in particular, and then I go into talking about what's the replacement for it. And I think that this is the case here, that Free File Sync will be a worthy replacement for it. And then I have slides available on how to set up this. And basically, this is the Q&A presentation I gave over a four-week period on how to set up Free File Sync as a replacement for file history.
Okay, hi Chris.
Okay.
So Carol has a note here that she tried to join the members forum, but it's still not showing up in her Google Groups. So I did check and she's not registered, and I suggested she send you a message, Chris. So Carol, basically, if anybody here is a member of the PC User Group, but you're not a member of the OPCUG member forum, this is a 24/7 kind of helpline, if you like. You can log on and post messages, post questions, see what people are talking about. But you have to be a registered member, and you have to be approved by Chris as the sysop to be part of the group. So you just need to send him a memo and an email, and he will take care of registering you for the members-only forum.
Yeah, send me an email from the email address that you want added to the member forum, or as a, if you want, you can send it from another one, but say what email address you want to be subscribed to the member forum. Things are a little bit easier if you happen to have a Gmail account, but if you want to register another email address, that's fine. You can interact with the member forum through email, through any email address without any difficulty at all. If you want to be able to access the forum on the web, which allows you to go back in time and see all of the conversations that have gone on previously on the forum, it's much easier in that case if you actually subscribe using a Gmail address, because Google, if you access it through the web, you have to be authenticated by Google. And every Gmail address is automatically a Google account as well. If you register another email address, then you have to go through the extra steps of making that other email address a Google account, which is not a showstopper, but it's just faster and easier if you register using a Gmail address. If you have any questions about further on that, by all means, just email me. So when you email me, because you may be emailing from an email address that is not in the membership database, be sure to give me your snail mail address, phone number or membership number, something that I can validate your membership through the membership database, and then I will get you set up, no problem at all.
Okay, another question about the Nova program that you talked about. The question is, have you tried looking for the PBS app? You just did a look in the Apple store.
I have not. I just did it through the web. I'm a little bit loath to add apps to my phone if I don't have to, and I don't particularly like using my phone with a small screen. As I sit here on a 34-inch 4K monitor, I much prefer watching videos and things like that on that rather than a small phone. So I have not looked into the Nova app at all.
And then just a question for me, Chris, on the PBS thing. Sometimes the PBS programs are only available to members of whatever they call their PBS thing. So this one must be available to the general public.
I guess so, because I'm not a member of anything at PBS, and it came up okay. The one thing I did find is there was something last week's Nova episode looked real interesting as well, and I was going to put that in, but that's not available yet. So it looks like it's about a two-week delay before they actually post them to be available over the web. I don't know about the PBS app, whether they're more immediately available or not. Yeah, the other one was actually about the eclipse, and that was kind of unfortunate because by the time it becomes available for public viewing, the eclipse will be gone. So.
Very useful.
Yeah.
So Josh has a question here. He says, after the last Windows update, after some time in rebooting, it killed my Firefox on one machine and Chrome on another computer. He'd never seen that before. He was able to restart them, but Firefox had lost the history. Has anybody had a similar experience?
What version of Windows are you on, Josh?
The latest update.
Windows 10 or 11?
Windows 10.
And okay, I've got Windows 10 still on one of my laptops. It has the latest update, and I did not have Firefox killed on it. I've got Firefox on that machine. I don't think it got killed on there. I use Chrome on all my machines, and I didn't have it on mine killed. So did anybody else have any experience like that?
I had an experience on that today. That friend I was trying to help had lost the bookmarks on the browser. And she'd also lost the documents and the images, the pictures folders. There was nothing showing in those. And it turned out that she'd actually logged on by mistake to the admin account.
Oh.
And everything was pointing to different things.
That'll do it.
Yeah, in my case, I was just using Firefox, and all of a sudden disappeared. Same thing with Chrome on their machine. I have no explanation, no warning, no nothing. Just disappeared.
Very odd.
About Edge?
I did not try that. If I did believe in conspiracy, I would say that might be the reason.
Yeah, so Natalie said it's called PBS Passport. That's the account that they have.
Okay.
And there was a question earlier. Just have to go back to it now. Marvo says, has anyone looked into cable cutting and what is available in Canada?
Alan?
We actually have something coming up on that. Yes. Okay, go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say that... I'm probably good to go on the 17th to give a little talk on some of that stuff, IPTV.
Okay, perfect.
So we can probably answer some of those questions that time, a couple of weeks. And Chris, you mentioned that watching that PBS show, if you accessed it through Opera because of the built-in VPN, I suspect it's the default is in the U.S. I experienced that with the Opera app on my Android. I was trying to access something in Canada, and I was being geo-blocked, but I was using the Opera app on my Android.
Okay.
I thought I was in the States.
Yeah, one of the things that bugs me a little bit about the Opera VPN is that you have no control over where the VPN is located. I suspect that they generally do it out of the States, but who knows? I mean, the Opera is a worldwide sort of thing. So one would think that they would have VPNs around the world, but you can't select it. So, but I, anytime that I've tried to do anything that's geo-blocked, which is, I suspect has always been coming out of the States, Opera has had no problem with accessing it. All of the Comedy Central stuff, it seems to load every time if I do it through the Opera browser with the VPN enabled.
Yeah, Sergio gave a talk on free software some time ago, and one of the suggestions he used was to keep an eye on shareware on sale. So I generally do, and I found a fairly good VPN. It was actually called Getflix, presumably for the obvious reasons, to circumvent geo-blocking and access U.S. or other country Netflix. But on the shareware on sale, they had a hell of a good price for a lifetime using it. But the deal they had did not, it was a VPN for everything but Netflix, still called, that was the key. But I bought the version without the Netflix, and I use it all the time. When we're at the cottage, I like to stream. There's some web radio stations and different music things that I like to pipe to speakers outside when I'm working out in the garden. I use it all the time, man. Wonderful. It was, I think, $25 for life, so can't go wrong with that.
There's a couple of extra comments here. Elizabeth and Allison both say that they use antennae. Elizabeth says she lives in Kanata, gets a number of TV channels, but that doesn't include PBS.
Yeah.
So you get the ATV, but the number of channels and the quality of those, quality of the transmission is somewhat variable, I have found.
Okay.
You just need a tower.
Mark Calle as well, he switched to an antenna, and he was quite happy with it at the time. Got as many channels, I guess, as he wanted. But, yeah, some people use that in addition to streaming services, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I used to think your antenna is good because you basically you get the local stations and the local news.
Yeah.
And, of course, you have access to the network stuff. But
a lot depends where the antenna is located and where it's pointing and things like that.
Ideally, move to the top of a hill.
Precisely, yeah.
Yes.
I'm in Beacon Hill, and it doesn't necessarily work all that well, I'll tell you.
You're in the valley of Beacon Hill.
We're just a few minutes out of time, so let me wrap up by saying that you have 2 weeks to get your next set of questions in for Q&A. Because next week we have our April meeting, and it's going to be our very own Bob Harris, who's going to be talking about image generators using artificial intelligence. So if you're interested in creating novel images with AI, then that's going to be the show to watch, and it's going to be a good one. And because it's our regular meeting, then we don't have a Q&A after it, so there won't be a Q&A on April the 10th. So our next Q&A will be in 2 weeks on April the 17th. As usual, send in your questions and topics to our suggestion box address, and we'll be happy to add you to the agenda for the 17th. And that's everything I have for tonight. Hope everybody enjoyed the material we did have, and we'll see you next week at the regular meeting.
Have a great evening, folks.